and it inspired me to go down to Stedman's and just sort of start thumbing through the bargain bin of classical recordings.
I couldn't tell you how many times I've actually seen Megan play this song, but like the first time I saw it, pure goosebumps, like completely floored me.
Over the years, Gordy Sampson came to play, I think, 6 or 7 years, and we watched his career skyrocket.
I have real distinct memories of holding each of our babies and dancing around the room, and they love the motion of it, and they love the music.
Music is really what makes the visual come to life.
Our Spin Time DJ today is an American with a love of mystery and history. You may know Steve Barry from his numerous books, including The Amber Room and The Romanov Prophecy. His latest is The Lincoln Myth. In fact, the former attorney has more than 18 million books in print. They've been translated into 40 languages and sold in 51 countries. But Steve Barry also has a passion for the past, which led him and his wife to create History Matters, a foundation dedicated to historic preservation, which is why he was in Stratford PEI earlier this week as the special guest at the Stratford Heritage Committee's fundraiser. While there, he also taught a workshop and did a free event at Stratford Town Hall. Steve Barry, welcome to Main Street Spin Time.
It's great to be here.
So, from what I understand, it took 12 years, 85 rejections before you finally sold your first manuscript. What kept you going? Are you a masochist?
I think all writers have a little of that in them, but the only thing that keeps you going is a little voice in your head. Every writer I've ever met has a little voice in their head that tells them to write. It doesn't say write a bestseller and sell 18 million books and all that you just said there. It just says sit down and write. And I had that little voice for 10 years. I ignored it, and finally I listened to it in 1990 and started writing, and the voice will go quiet when you write. It hushes up. But as you said, it took 12 years. It was still a long process. I wanted it. You know, if you want it bad enough, you stay with it.
So what do you think, when you consider now how widely your books are selling now, what do you think the reason was that it took you so long to get accepted somewhere?
Oh, it's simple. The world changed. The world changed. I was writing books, action, history, secrets, conspiracies, international settings. Those were called spy thrillers back in the 90s, and that genre died when the Cold War ended. When the genre died, no one was buying the books anymore, so it was tough for a new writer to break in. So it was clearly just a matter of timing. When Da Vinci Code was published in 2003 by Random House, a year before that, they were looking for stuff to go with Da Vinci, and I was bought the second time around because Da Vinci brought the genre back, but not as a spy thriller, brought it back as action, history, secrets, conspiracy, international settings, which is exactly what I was writing. So I was in the right place at the right time on the 86th attempt.
Mm-hmm. Is that true that you credit nuns with instilling discipline and writing in you?
No question. I mean, writing is a discipline. You have to be disciplined to write. There's all kinds of discipline, but you still have to have it. It's not an obsession, but it is a discipline, and the nuns taught me that. Yeah, you went to Catholic school, and you came into school back in my day, and you said you didn't have your homework. Well, there was going to be some pain associated with that decision, and it wasn't any due process or hearings or go down and go through us. No, she's going to pick you up right there, and you're going to hurt. I mean, it's going to be painful.
So fear is behind your
question.
Discipline.
Absolutely, absolutely. I remember it. Clearly, those nuns, as I said many times, what those nuns used to do to us, you go to prison for today. That's how bad. You don't pick a child up and spank and beat them anymore. That's unheard of. You wouldn't even do it. But in Catholic school, it was a routine process. Now, they weren't cruel and they weren't abusive. They were tough, is what they were. And they're trying to teach you that there's consequences to your action.
I want to go right into the first tune. Can you set this up for me? Why did you pick this particular first tune? Where does it come from?
Well, I was born and raised in Georgia. So I've lived there 54 years. And 4 years ago, we moved to Florida. So we now live in St. Augustine, Florida, which is about 60 miles south of where we lived in Georgia. So, I went to school in Georgia. I went to college. I went to law school. I practiced law there for 30 years. And so every once in a while when you hear this song, it kind of sings to you a little bit that Georgia is on your mind, even though we live in Florida now.
Mm-hmm. Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said, Georgia, Georgia, a song of you. Comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines. Other arms reach out to me, other eyes smile tenderly. Still in the peaceful dreams I see, the road leads back to you. I said, Georgia, oh Georgia, no peace I find. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
Other arms reach out to me, other eyes smile tenderly. Still in peaceful dreams I see, the road leads back to you. Whoa, Georgia, Georgia, no peace I find. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Ray Charles singing Georgia on My Mind. That's our Spin Time DJ's pick today, Steve Berry. You grew up in the segregated South. You grew up in Georgia when it was segregated.
I remember it very well, yes. I remember separate bathrooms, separate water fountains, separate everything. That was like a way of life when I was a kid, yeah.
You also would have been there when things changed radically with the Civil Rights Movement.
I remember it all changed in the late 60s, early 70s is when it all began to transition. But Georgia was at the forefront of that. There was a lot of segregation fights there. We had a lot of battles back in those days. That was the home of Martin Luther King. That's where he was from. So, I witnessed all that and watched it. I was probably, like I said, the last generation. If you were born in the 50s, you got to see that. If you were born in the 60s, by the time you were old enough to understand, it was over. The more overt parts were over. Other parts took longer to deal with.
As a lover of history, when you look back in that time that you grew up in, that must seem like a different world, different planet.
Yeah, it was totally, completely, utterly foreign to where we would think today. Today, we would think that's ridiculous.
You know that old phrase, history is written by the winners. Does the way we record history need to change from the way we've done it in the past? Is it changing currently now?
Oh, yeah,
now,
there's no question. Think? That's what the internet's doing now. History's not recorded by the winners anymore. History's recorded by everybody. Everybody records history now, and it's not always right, and it's not always accurate. So the internet has changed all of that. And I think, like, regimes around the world are figuring that out. You know, even China, they're trying to suppress the internet. Places, Russia the other day, today. I just read, you know, where he shuts off. He's trying to cut it off because it's so volatile. So History Today wouldn't be written by the winners anymore. History Today would be written by every single person on the planet.
When you think about the history of your own life, what parts of it do you want to have remembered?
Ooh, that's a big question. That's a tough one to think about. I think you would want to be remembered that you were a good person, that you did good things. I mean, that's really what everybody would like to be remembered about, that you left a mark and that you were remembered and that there were good thoughts thought about you because of what you did in your life. I think everyone would want that.
This next tune, I hear, has been called your theme song. Can you explain that?
I guess my 16-year-old would call that. She adopted this as my theme song a long time ago, which I'm not sure if she's being, I'm not sure if it's complimentary or what, but always at Christmas time when this song comes on, she turns it up loud and she says, "There's Daddy's song. It's Daddy's song." So it did kind of become my theme song. And I think what she's saying is that he's tough on the outside, but a softy on the inside, because that's exactly what the Grinch is. The Grinch was tough on the outside, but soft inside.
"You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel. You're a monster, Mr. Grinch. Your heart's an empty hole. Your brain is full of spiders. You've got garlic in your soul, Mr. Grinch. I wouldn't touch you with a 39 and a half foot pole. You're a vile one, Mr. Grinch. You have termites in your smile. You have all the tender sweetness of a seasick crocodile, Mr. Grinch. Given the choice between the two of you, I'd take the seasick crocodile. You're a foul one, Mr. Grinch. You're a nasty, wasty skunk. Your heart is full of unwashed socks. Your soul is full of gunk, Mr. Grinch. The three words that best describe you are as follows, and I quote, stink, stank, stunk. You're a rotter, Mr. Grinch. You're the king of sinful sots. Your heart's a dead tomato splotched with moldy purple spots, Mr. Grinch. Your soul is an appalling dump heap, overflowing with the most disgraceful assortment of deplorable rubbish imaginable, mangled up in tangled up knots. You nauseate me, Mr. Grinch, with a nauseous soup.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. That's pick two of our Spin Time DJ today, Steve Berry. Steve, what is it about history and mystery and conspiracy that you love so much? Where does that come from? What happened to you, Steve, that you love those things?
I don't know. It's always been there. I've always liked that type of book because I tell people all the time, you know, don't write what you know. Writing what you know is very bad advice. Instead, write what you love. If what you know and what you love are the same thing, great, but it's not for me. I was a lawyer, but I didn't want to write about that. I just like things from history, things lost and forgotten, things you don't know a lot about, like the Library of Alexandria or the Tomb of Alexander the Great or Charlemagne or clauses in our in the Constitution that are very interesting. All these things that you may not know a lot about, it fascinates me. And so I just gravitated to write what I loved.
Are there chunks in your own family history that you don't know about?
Not really. I mean, my mother's family's from Lebanon, so I don't know a lot about that side over there. She's full-blooded Lebanese. So there's some of that there that's a mystery. But no, there's not that. That didn't ever drive me. I just always like cool things from the past that we just didn't know anything about, and we want to know more about them. You know, what is it about them? The new book I have deals with Lincoln, and there's a whole bunch of things about Abraham Lincoln we don't know anything about, and it fascinated me, these myths that we know nothing about.
It seems to me, like, as a Canadian looking in at Americans, that America is fascinated by its own history in a way that Canadians aren't as fascinated by their own history.
Yes, it is, because I would look at it from an American and from our standpoint, I don't think a lot of people, they're fascinated by our history, but they don't know anything about our history. Americans do. They don't really study it like they should. We're not studied in school in the same way. It's a subject, oh, darn, I got to do history. You know, they're not excited about it. But they like to hear about stuff, but they also like more than anything else the myths, those things that aren't real. And Lincoln is a good example. He's loaded with myth. That sounds great. But the truth, to me, is even more fascinating. But Americans, by and large, aren't going to spend the time to do that. I mean, we have a real lapse in that, in them appreciating their history a little more.
I wonder if part of that is, too, if you're going to look back in history, you have to look at the things that went well, but you also have to look at numerous things that did not go well.
And we have a bad habit of looking at only the bad stuff. We do that. But you have to look at both. There's no question. And you have to study both because you learn from both. And both of them are interesting. And, you know, people like conflict. They like controversy. They like those things. And so they gravitate to those more than anything else.
Steve, just before you go, I want to ask you, has this visit to Prince Edward Island, has it inspired you?
Oh, it's been wonderful. We've loved it here, and so much so that I'm going to work it into the 2016 novel. I think a chunk of the novel may take place right here on Prince Edward Island.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. There's many mysterious people here.
There are, and I'm going to add a new one. I'm going to create a new one and do it and do a little damage to the place at the same time because it's a thriller, so we have to do a little damage.
Of course. This third tune, I feel like your pick for this is revealing some kind of secret career desire.
Well, I mean, come on now. Who wouldn't want to be a rock star? come on. I mean, if you ask somebody, do you want to be a rock star? Who's going to say no? Who's going to say, no, I don't want to do that?
So if you weren't an attorney and you weren't a novelist, you would be a rock star.
I'd be a rock star.
All right, what kind of tattoo would you have if you were a rock star?
Because
I like
you
would need a tattoo.
Oh, I like those little spikes on the forearm around here and all that. And I've tried to get those, but Elizabeth won't let me have them. She won't let me have any of those. So I think
she would be your lead groupie in this rock star fantasy.
She would, and she'd be great at it,
I don't know how
too.
She'd feel about that.
But. No, she'd be good at it. She'd be good at the groupies. Yeah, she'd be a great groupie.
I don't know how pleased she is going to.
No, she likes
that.
This song, I remember when it came out, and I'm also giving a little shout out here to the Canadians because it's Nickelback, and so. But I always liked this song, and I always thought it just really says, you know, if you're going to be something, be a rock star. It's really cool.
Will you, as this song plays, be playing air guitar?
Not here, no. But if I was alone, maybe.
Uh-huh. Steve, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Steve Barry is the author of numerous books, including The Amber Room and The Romanov Prophecy. His latest is The Lincoln Myth.
I'm through with standing in line. The clubs I'll never get in. It's like the bottom of the ninth, and I'm never gonna win this. Life hasn't turned out quite the way I want it to be.
Tell me what you want.
I want a brand new house on an episode of Cribs, and a bathroom I can play baseball in, and a king-size tub big enough for 10 plus me.
Yeah, so what you need?
I'll need a credit card that's got no limit, and a big black jet with a bedroom in it. Gonna join the Mile High Club at 37,000 feet.
Been done that.
I want a new tour bus full of old guitars, mine star on Hollywood Boulevard. Somewhere between Cher and James Dean is fine for me.
So how you gonna do it?
I'm gonna trade this life for fortune and fame. I'd even cut my hair and change my name. Cause we all just wanna be big rock stars and live in hilltop buses driving 15 cars. The girls come easy and the drugs come cheap. Well, I'll stay skinny cause we just won't eat. And we'll hang out in the coolest bar in the VIP with the movie stars. Every good gold digger's gonna wind up there. Every playboy bunny with a bleached blonde hair. And well, hey, hey, I wanna be a rock star. Hey, hey, I wanna be castles, hire 8 bodyguards that love to beat up assholes, sign a couple lot of grass so I can eat my meals for free.
I have the quesadilla.
I'm gonna dress my ass with the latest fashion, get a front door key to the Playboy mansion, gonna date a centiphone that loves to blow my money for me.
So how you gonna do it?
I'm gonna trade this life for fortune and fame. I'd even cut my hair and change my name, 'cause we all just wanna be big rock stars and live in hilltop houses driving 15 cars. The girls come easy and the drugs come cheap. Well, I'll stay skinny 'cause we just won't eat, and we'll hang out in the coolest bars and the VIP with the movie stars. Every good gold digger's gonna wind up there, every playboy bunny with the bleach blonde hair, and we'll hide out in the private rooms with the latest dictionary of today's zoo. They'll get you anything with that evil smile. Everybody's got a drug dealer on speed dial. Well, hey, hey, I wanna be a rock star. I'm gonna sing those songs that offend the senses, gonna pop my pills from a best dispenser, get washed up singers writing all my songs, lip sync them every night so I don't get them wrong. Well, we all just wanna be big rock stars and live in hilltop houses driving 15 cars. The girls come easy and the drugs come cheap. We'll all stay skinny 'cause we just won't eat, and we'll hang out in the coolest bars and the VIP with the movie stars. Every good girl